Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette, episode 23. Welcome to Real Talk Radio with Nicole Antoinette. That's me, the podcast that's filled with refreshingly honest conversations about the wonderful mess of being human. As your host, it's my delightful honor to sit down with a wide range of people, athletes, writers, entrepreneurs, parents, coaches, spiritual teachers, artists, and more, to dive into the truth of what's really going on in their lives. We go deep on all the behind-the-scenes stuff, like fears, secret dreams, guilty pleasures, embarrassing stories, goal-setting systems, self-care practices, and day-to-day routines, plus an honest breakdown of what it's like to go after your dreams, big or small, in real life. Honestly, my hope is just that each episode of this podcast makes you laugh, think, and maybe just feel less alone. It's also an awesome chance for me to share a few of my favorite things with you, tools, products, programs, just things that I use and love in my everyday life. And I'll be doing this by partnering up with one company per season to offer you a special treat. So this season, if you have been listening along, you know that I've partnered with Audible, which is my go-to place for audiobooks. If you know me and have been in my corner of the internet for any length of time, you'll know that I am a total book junkie. And one of the ways that I'm able to read so much is that I listen to a lot of my books while doing other things, like running or driving or cleaning or doing errands. I just love to have books on while I'm doing other stuff. It's such a fun and easy way to read more without actually reading more, you know? So if you're into audiobooks, then Audible is definitely where you want to be. They have over 180,000 books to choose from, and you can get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial by going to audibletrial.com/realtalkradio. It's super simple, totally worth it. You get a free audiobook. If you're looking for some recommendations, I have got those. There's plenty of things in the show notes of all the episodes. But if you want something that's inspirational, real, and athletic, check out Finding Ultra by Rich Roll. Love that one. If you're into bad boy romance books like me, those are my guilty pleasure novels, try Beautiful Disaster by Jamie McGuire. I loved that one, particularly because it was so well narrated. So the audio version was way better even than just reading it would have been. The point is, there are a ridiculous number of books to choose from, so no matter what, you'll definitely find something that you love. To grab your free book, the URL one more time is audibletrial.com/realtalkradio. Okay, so let's get to today's show. In each episode, I bring you an in-depth conversation with a new guest, and in today's episode, you'll get to meet Brian Gardner. Brian is a partner and chief product officer at Rainmaker Digital, a media company that provides tools and training for content marketers and digital entrepreneurs. He's the founder of Studio Press, a creative line of business that's the industry standard for premium WordPress themes. And he's also the creator of No Sidebar, a blog that helps people design a simple life by focusing on five areas: digital, home, life, mind, and work. In this episode, Brian tells the story of how he essentially taught himself about design and WordPress kind of from nothing while working full-time, and then went on to create Studio Press, the leader in premium WordPress themes that's now used by something crazy like over 160,000 websites, something like that. It's insane. I love it. And the best part is that Brian's such a kind and humble guy, and he's committed to authenticity in business and life, which is something that we definitely talk about in this conversation, especially the dilemma of wanting to be authentic, but struggling with when to let other people in on whatever creative project you're working on, you know, how close to keep it to yourself, when to start to share your creativity with others. And that's something that I have struggled with a lot myself. So I enjoyed talking about that with Brian. Also, he shares his views on minimalism and simplicity, why he doesn't read very much, how he became a long distance runner. Running's definitely something that we have in common. I think that's how we first met. So we talk about that. He shares his current obsession with Lana Del Rey's music and more. We actually wound up talking about Twilight. We are both Twilight fans, which is something I did not know about Brian before this. So it's a fun, well-rounded conversation that left me thinking about the power of unexpected opportunities. That's something we talk about. And I really hope you enjoy it. It was so fun to have Brian on the show. All of that starts in just a moment. And as always, you'll be able to find the links and the resources that were mentioned in this episode over in the show notes at NicoleAntoinette.com/podcast. Okay, awesome. We are rolling and good to go. Brian, welcome to the show.
Wow, you introduced me too quickly. I was drinking a glass of water when you said that.
That's okay. In a two-hour podcast, you're allowed to take hydration breaks. I have on my desk right now a bottle of water, a thermos of tea, and also a green smoothie. So don't worry.
We're both runners. Maybe we should be wearing our hydration belts instead.
I know. Actually, though, my fear is always that in this length of podcast, I'm like, oh my God, what if I drink too much tea and then I just sit here having to go to the bathroom the whole time? So I got to balance my hydration needs with my not wanting to get up and go to the bathroom during a podcast.
Yes.
Well, that started it out very real. So you mentioned that we are both runners, and I was thinking this morning, trying to remember who introduced us, which I can't remember, but I think it was something running related, right? Do you remember?
You know, I don't know if it was running related, or it may have been right around the time I was doing this unfiltered site where I was talking about authenticity and stuff like that. And I think maybe that may have been when someone dropped in. And if I think long and hard enough, I can probably come up with who it was. Or if it was through Facebook, maybe I can do a search on my own timeline or whatever. But someone clearly said that you need to get to know Nicole, follow her, read her stuff, because very like-minded people we are. And it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, the other thing I shared with you just before we started recording that I'll say again, I was actually a little stressed out this morning because I feel like there's so many like different huge conversations that you and I could have. There's so much stuff about like both your creative work and running and thoughts on, you know, like you said, being unfiltered, living deliberately. I was like, okay, deep breath. Whatever comes out in the conversation is what's supposed to come out.
Well, that's the story of my life. I go through my days are like that, where I almost stress myself out because I'm thinking to myself, okay, I have to run, and then I have to do some creative stuff, and then I have to do some business stuff, and then there's some room for authenticity, no sidebar stuff. Then I got to be a dad when Zach gets home, and then a husband later for Shelly. And so in my own mind, I think I trip myself out. Like, what role am I playing right now?
Do you find, I mean, this idea of like balance, right, like comes up a lot and gets thrown around a lot, that balance for you does look like including some of all of those most days? Or do you tend to go in phases of right now I'm really just focusing on business and right now I'm really just focusing on running?
You know, I scatter myself quite a bit. Part of the, you know, being a creative is allowing yourself to kind of mindlessly wander. For me, it's the internet. It's, you know, going through websites and looking for inspiration on design and other creative stuff like that. So I was talking to someone the other day and they were asking about that. You know, when you go to work, do you just shut off the internet? And I said, no, because that's part of my work. That's, you know, part of what I do for a living is, you know, going out and seeking interesting stuff, well-designed sites, because I use that for inspiration on things that I create that we in turn sell. And so that's really for me the biggest thing is trying to figure out where to draw the line in the sand, which is too much consumption versus too little production and vice versa.
And have you found kind of a happy medium there or anything like boundary wise that works well for you? Because I am perpetually having the same struggle.
You know, sometimes it's as easy as just turning something off. There, last week or the week before, I wanted to work on a design, and I said, and of course I have to broadcast this through social media because we all have a need to just tell everybody in the world what we're doing or why we're doing it. I said, don't ping me tomorrow because I'm turning everything off because I have to be creative, Brian. And so I turned social media, Skype, everything off for 4 or 5 hours. And it's amazing how much you can get done when you kind of block yourself from all of those outside things that can kind of get in the way.
Yeah, sometimes I find that I give myself a hard time about, you know, well, I shouldn't need to go to the cafe that doesn't have Wi-Fi. Like, I should be able to just, like, not open Twitter. But, like, sometimes you just have to do, like, whatever it takes in order for you to do your work. Just, like, set those conditions up for yourself, right?
Yeah, no, I'm the kind of guy who's wired to do things in short sprints. And so, you know, I'll spend an hour or two, like, working through some stuff, turn something off, then I'll go run for an hour. And so I don't do the traditional 9 to 5. People ask, you know, what does your typical day look like? And I said schizophrenic, you know, because that's really the best way to explain it. It's all over the place. And it works because as creatives, I think we're kind of, you know, wired better to handle kind of the ups and downs and the lefts and rights.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with my friend Julia the other day about like honoring whatever your own work patterns are. And we were discussing how, you know, we're totally different. And she's kind of more of like a marathon person, meaning if she has a big project, you know, work on it a little bit at a time every single day. Whereas I'm more of what I think of like a sprint person. Like I would rather blinders on, like work on something for like 12 hours, 3 days in a row and be done with it. And, you know, we just kind of talked about how there's a lot of productivity advice that would say, this is the way you have to do things, or you have to be a morning person. But I think there's something to be said for honoring, like, if, you know, if it is for you, work an hour, run an hour, do the thing, like, that's fine, right? We like try to fit into the molds of like how to, quote, like be the most productive person.
You know, I think that goes beyond productivity, though. I run a site called No Sidebar, as you know, and a lot of what we talk about are topics kind of around simple living and minimalism. And Joshua Becker is a really good friend of mine. He runs a site called Becoming Minimalist. And so we talk about, you know, what does minimalism look like? And just like you explained with productivity, I think, you know, the gurus, right, quote unquote, like to say this is the mold or the formula that you have to do things a certain way to be productive. And the same kind of thing goes with minimalism, where people think there's a very specific criteria. You have to do X, give away X, live in a, you know, house no bigger than X. And if you are, then you're a minimalist, which is completely off the wall in terms of rationale. You know, Joshua likes to say, and I completely agree with him, that minimalism is really more of a mindset, right? What works specifically for you and how you're wired and what you feel comfortable with. And with productivity, it's the same thing. You know, everything looks different for different people. And I think, you know, sometimes people get too much on a soapbox and they say, I'm, you know, king productivity guy or queen minimalist. And if you don't do it this way, then you're not one of those types of people, which is completely, I think, completely a misconception.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to just like the desire to fit into something, like the desire to belong to something. And the fact that the more extreme stories, right, the person who only owns 100 items or whatever, that that's the kind of stuff that gets more like viral traction, because those stories are interesting and kind of offbeat or whatever, that then it becomes easy to think, okay, well, if I want to fit in with this thing, like this is the criteria to fit in.
You know, I'm going through a season right now where I try to fit myself into so many different molds. It's almost depressing. It gets to a point where, you know, you've got imposter syndrome. You have this, if I'm not like X or do it like X or this type of person, then I'm not doing it right. And I keep coming back to, and I swear there are quotes on the internet or things that I read that haunt me in a good way. And something I came across from a designer in Nashville, her name is Ruthie Lindsay. And she says, you know, some of the things, we're so into this idea of authenticity that one of the things that cripples us is this fear that, you know, what I do doesn't matter. And ironically, what she says is the things that we do that we think will repel people the most are the ones that attract us or attract, you know, are the most attractive to them. And so, you know, sometimes it's like I want to kind of do the middle finger thing and say, you know what, I'm going to completely do it my way. I'm going to go against the grain. I'm going to break the mold. And, you know, indirectly, that type of a mindset, I think, is what really builds up you know, a personal brand or a following even more, because it's the people who are seen as not the robots of the world, and those who have their own identity, you know, their own idea of where I want to go and how I want to do things. Those are the people that I think we, you know, draw and are drawn to ourselves.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I actually, so you mentioned minimalism. That was one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. Where along the way, I guess, like the way of your life, did you become interested in this idea of minimalism? Like, how did that find its way into your life?
For me, it really came through from a design perspective. I entered into that world really because I got really as a designer and somebody who does stuff for the web, sometimes I get frustrated with going to websites, people who had sidebars and things in sidebars who I think just put them there because they think they're supposed to be there or they've been told to be there. You have to, you know, have a Twitter widget, a Facebook widget, a this and that. And I would go to websites wanting to read good content, and all I was completely bombarded with are, you know, follow me, click here, you know, these sales pitches all over the screen. And so as a person who got frustrated with that, I said, well, you know, I can't go tell everybody to take a sidebar off their website because that's nonsense, right? And so I started to just do it myself and kind of documented the mentality of what I was doing and why I was doing it. So I removed a sidebar from my own site, and it was just clean. Like, the idea of white space on my own site was a breath of fresh air. And so little by little, that kind of mentality kind of eked its way into my life. And I read a book 2 years ago by my friend Allison Vesterfeld called Packing Light, which was a story about her going across country and selling everything she owned so that she could just kind of go experience life. And I started to kind of think of it from that aspect too, which is, you know, what is in the way of what we want to do from a web perspective, from a life and a journey perspective. And so, you know, that kind of bred into fears and authenticity and the things that were, you know, usually unsaid by people, by myself, by others. You know, this is kind of getting in the way of progress, success, the next thing. And so that kind of came together. And as I was trying to identify, you know, what that looked like, I, of course, entrepreneurial Brian pops up and says, you know, here's an idea, something that's cool. People may follow it, and I'll go build a website and a brand around it.
Yeah, there's so much good stuff in there that we could dig into. So this, it sounds like it was kind of a natural progression for you, came in through design work and then, you know, started to raise some questions in other areas of your life. And that idea of kind of like what's getting in the way or what's blocking me from kind of doing what I want to do, whether that's like, however we think of like excess baggage, what specifically outside of design came up for you that you were like, ooh, this is something that I want to get rid of in, you know, hopes of kind of living more simply and living more in line with the things that do matter?
You know, it's funny. I, you know, no sidebar is simple living and minimalism, but one of the things that we're going into this year that I very specifically want to address is the idea of going deeper. Not so much let's just remove and throw everything away, but more the why behind it. And so outside of, you know, websites and no sidebars in websites and so on, for me, it really became a question of like the honesty in our life. That for me, very on an intellectual level, I wanted to remove, you know, the untruths and the things that I would hold back on, because they would keep me from various things, you know, things in my marriage, things with my friends, things within our company. And just the idea of trying to remove, you know, the mask, you know, the things that we kind of hide behind the facade. Because for me, I was just so tired of trying to live a life that I was presenting through social media, you know, the whole filter effect and all of that. And so it really didn't come down to tangible goods. You know, I, by nature, kind of am a parer downer. Nice word. I don't know if that exists, but there's reality right there.
I know. It does now. Hey, it does now. That's our word. Yeah. It's fine.
Put it in Urban Dictionary. I don't like to hoard and collect much anyways. That has always been how I've been. So for me, it means less about, you know, capsule wardrobes and, you know, things that kind of quote unquote real minimalists think that it kind of it covers. And for me, it was more a philosophical thing.
Okay. So I'm curious, I mean, this is me just like being nosy, right? And digging into this. Was there a specific instance or a situation that you can remember where you were like, okay, this is something that maybe I wasn't being honest about that now I'm going to try to do exactly what you said, like go deeper?
You know, I don't know if there was anything specific. I do remember, though, a couple years ago, we had a partner meeting in Boulder, Colorado, where it was just the five of us partners at Copyblogger, where I was withholding how much stress and anxiety I was feeling with all the work that I was doing. And I completely melted down in front of our four other partners. And they said something to me that was just really interesting, which was, you know, take the next month off. Don't touch work. Don't think about work. And I was thinking to myself, as nice as that sounded, it was kind of unrealistic because I do need work, right? I think some of us who are wired that way, my guess is you are too, where you need to have something to do at some point or you go completely loony. You know, so looking back, that might be kind of the one of the maybe early catalysts of, you know, what did a specific situation look like where I was, it finally just kind of just, you burst, right? That's typically how things go when you bottle stuff up.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot lately about kind of those extreme situations. Like if I look back at my life, there's definitely a lot of those like meltdown, kind of like dramatic breakdown moments. And I think sometimes, I don't know, okay, so I'm not going to put this on anyone else. Me personally, it's like the only time that I give myself like real permission to like rest or pull back is like in the face of something really dramatic like that happening. And something that I'm trying to work on and I've been trying to work on the last couple months is not ever needing to get to that point, right? Like there's something, even though like having a meltdown sucks, there's something inherently sexy about it, I think, where people are like, oh my God, like, you know, she worked so hard and like we like prize that. And there's like a badge of honor around that. And then you have this kind of dramatic situation. And then, well, of course you need to take care of yourself and recover. But like, how do we not get there, right? Like, was there something coming out of that experience for you that you were like, okay, here are some things that I need to do to not, you know, every 5 months get to like meltdown status?
I'm a recent fan, I'll admit, of the musician Lana Del Rey. I don't know if you know who she is, but I'm creatively infatuated with her at the moment. And I saw an interview. She's very vocal and poignant about the fact that she kind of is unhappy with all of the success, and she's a very kind of authentically transparent person. And one of the panelists that was in this little discussion said sometimes, and he thinks this is the case with her, sometimes we need to live in that type of stuff, right? The mess of life, the garbage of life, where we're unhappy and we need to be unhappy so that we can be happier, so we can use that for our creative work. And I think there's a ton of truth in that, because I sometimes like and thrive when I kind of get into depressive Brian mode, where I can go off, because what it does is it catalyzes creative processes that really help some of my best work come out, whether it's design, whether it's writing, whatever it might be. And I think, if you look at the early people back in the days, like Picasso and those artists way back in the day, they were all depressed, but they needed that so that they could be creative and all of that. And so, yes, we need to make sure we don't get to meltdown mode, but I can't also completely blind myself from going through, you know, various levels of experiencing, you know, sort of the unhappiness of life, because that for me is really helpful at times.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think this actually was like one of my fears when I quit drinking, was that like all of a sudden I wasn't going to be this kind of like crazy up and down roller coaster, I don't know, person that I was like, oh my God, am I going to have anything to write about? Or like I was definitely attached to this idea of, you know, in order to be a writer, your life has to look like X, right? So I think there's truth in what you're saying. But for me, the other side of that is that sometimes I can over-identify with that.
Yeah, I know for a fact that people, as much as they appreciate my authenticity and the stuff that I like to share, my personal stuff gets nowhere near the response as the stuff that I create. And I know that because I wrote very specifically a newsletter one time that had a couple of links to things, one of which was a very personal journal entry. And then there was another two links that were to things I had created for the web, i.e. designs and WordPress stuff. And so I went into MailChimp one morning. And it was a pretty good sample size. I sent it out to 10,000 people, so I had a pretty good indication of what people want from me when I looked at the click map. And there was three options, and the personal entry was 10%, and the other two were roughly 45% each. And so as much as I like to live inside of some of that stuff, that's not the stuff people want to, you know, that should be an inward thing, right? You go through that, you feel it, you experience it, kind of behind closed doors, you use that to catalyze creative stuff. But sometimes people don't need to read it, right? You don't have to broadcast, hey, I'm, you know, going through a bad season. Not always. I mean, I think some areas on the web, that's appropriate. But just the, you know, barfing on Twitter or Facebook, which I have a tendency to do and get called out from time to time, isn't, people don't like that, you know, or at least what I've learned. My audience responds much better to the stuff that I create versus, you know, how I create it.
That's interesting. Well, I mean, and I think that brings up an interesting question kind of with what you're doing, some of the writing that you're doing right now and this idea of living authentically. Like, how do you handle the fact that, I don't know, that kind of this brand that you've built or what people expect from you, that you want to do more than that, that maybe that this specific group of people aren't as responsive to? Like, what has that kind of transition been like for you?
You know, it's been a tough transition because I've always been a people pleaser in my life, and I always thrive on the attention that I get from other people. And so, and that's all to a fault, mind you. And as much as I want a response for the personal stuff, you know, I think if I maintain a small percentage of what I do, how I present myself online, that I think that's appropriate, right? The 10 to 20%. Of that is appropriate, because then I'm not throwing it out there 90% of the time, which breeds the possibility of rejection when 90% of what I output is personal and I don't get much of a response. That has a tendency to be quite damaging, you know, to the what no one likes me type of stuff. And so I'm trying to be very intentional with, you know, social media in particular, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, to say, okay, enough of the this, let's get some more of that, and try to focus on, you know, doing things like producing art or creative works that people respond to, because that's a rewarding thing, right? When people buy it or pay for it or hit you up on the side and say, hey, I really appreciate what you did. That's a very rewarding thing. And so I want to, first of all, that benefits the company too. And so there's a responsibility I have to make sure that I'm not spending 90% of my time in the closet and 10% of my time behind the desk. And so it's ongoing. It's always a struggle, because as much as I like to write up a manual on how I should do it, I never follow it. So just do your best.
Yeah. So Switching gears totally, going back, I know we mentioned running a little bit at the beginning. I'm curious what your running looks like these days. What, are you training for something? What's going on with running for you?
So running for me, I've the last 4 or 5 months have kicked it back into gear. I've always been, I've always enjoyed the long distance running versus the short distance sprinting. I started out doing 5Ks just because I wasn't conditioned. But once I ran my first half marathon, which was, the Rock and Roll in Las Vegas a few years back, I was hooked and addicted to the whole idea of working through, you know, pain. And of course, there's no walls really in a half marathon, but just the idea of struggling. I remember when I finished, I said, I just want to die, but I really like how I'm feeling. And so, so for me, running is cathartic. It helps break up my day. And so I don't train for anything specific. I've been running half marathons over the last, 4 or 5 years, probably about 6 a year. And so I'm just always just ongoingly in shape and trying to train to get a little bit faster and stuff like that. But as you hit 40, things start to change, right? There's this saying in the running world, the older I get, the faster I was. And that for me is like totally true. It's like there's more work now to maintain a pace. And so I go through seasons of, you know, wanting to try to PR versus, you know, I killed a race 2 years ago with a PR and I'll never be able to get there again kind of thing. And so it's a balance, but I think we all need something like that in our lives.
How did you first get into running? Did you run when you were younger, when you were in school?
No, not really. My wife, Shelley, has been a runner, and she was training with a good friend of ours at Lifetime Fitness, who was also a runner. And so we were sitting around on a double date one night. At the time, I was weightlifting, and they were talking about going to this Las Vegas Rock and Roll Marathon, and it'd be fun if we all went together. And I said, well, you know, no offense, but I don't want to go to this thing, the four of us, and have the three of you run. So either we're not going or I'm going to run. And they all kind of looked at me funny because it was probably 2 or 3 months out. And I said, hey, you know, you only live once, right? YOLO. And so I started to kind of try kind of the couch to the 5K half marathon thing the first month. And I think 2:15 was my time in that one. And since then, I've probably dropped 30 or 40 pounds. And my PR now is a 137. So for me, once I ran that race, like, it became like a mission. I literally stopped weightlifting cold turkey, and my wife was like, what happened? I said, I don't know. I found something I love.
I love that. What do you feel like you've learned about yourself through this experience of running the last couple of years?
You know, it sounds cliche, but the whole you can do it, break through the wall thing. I think we also need to, what I've learned probably the most as I kind of walk around that question is that I think I need to challenge myself more and more, that I live within a comfort zone, because half marathons for me are easy. Yes, you know, sometimes it's warmer one day than another day. And so you kind of within that context, you know, you have highs and lows. But I signed up for a 20 miler a year and a half ago. And when I ran that, it was my first experience ever with the quote unquote wall, which I'm sure you're aware of. And I was like, this was like another dimension. Like miles 13 through 20 were completely different than anything I'd ever run before, because I had never done them before. And so as much as I live within this half marathon thing, like, you know, sometimes you got to go out and just try different things and experience different types of highs and lows, because otherwise it gets boring. And so as I was going through the wall, I was literally like, oh my God, I almost felt euphoric. And by the time I finished, I went home and I told Shelley, I'm like, I actually physically encountered the wall, and it was weird. It was unexpected, and it pushed me. I, for the first time maybe ever, really wanted to throw in the towel on running and not finish a race. It was just really strange, but it was good because it stretched me and it said, you know, you fought through it, you can do it, and kind of all the cliches around that. But I don't know. I think we need to challenge ourselves more than we do.
No, I agree with that. I mean, I think I had my friend Jeff Sanders on this season too, and he and I talked about how comfort can be a trap, right? And, you know, I think something that I'm thinking about in like my own running is I get bored really easily. I mean, I think I get bored really easily in life in general. And it's always kind of like onto the next thing, onto something new. And that maybe that there's a point where that becomes burnout, right? That it's like too many new things, but like I want to do a different race distance, or, you know, focus on something else that I've never done before. Because there is something, like you said, that's like pretty neat about doing something for the first time, right? Like, I mean, I remember the first time that I ran marathon, you know, and it was after mile 20, that had been the farthest that I'd ever run in a training run. And like every single step is like, this is the farthest I've ever run in my life. No, this is the farthest I've ever run in my life. Like there's something about that that I feel, I mean, obviously people get it in ways other than running, but I agree with you that like having something in your life that lets you on like a sort of regular basis do something that you haven't done before, like there really is no substitute for that.
It's funny. There are only a couple of things online that instantly connect me to people outside of the fact that we're on social media and entrepreneurs and things like that. But for me, it's running and it's, believe it or not, Starbucks. That's kind of the two things I've been kind of known as, the runner guy and the Starbucks guy. And so when I first started following you, like instantly I'm drawn to you, and I follow you because I love seeing the pictures that you post, especially when you move to Oregon and all of that, where, you know, the scenery is even better. And there's just something about the fact that, hey, there's someone else who probably knows who Shalane Flanagan is or Kara Goucher. And I'm like, that in my little world is really cool. And so there's an instant connection. It almost makes people like that unfollowable, right? Because I'm like, they get it. They're in my world. They totally understand me. And I don't know, it's just kind of cool to have those types of people.
Yeah, there's definitely a bond that forms with running. I mean, for me, like I came to running a little bit differently. That I quit drinking and started running on the same day, right? It was like really a way out of kind of a previous lifestyle for me. And there was something that was so healing and comforting about kind of having this immediate community of runners, you know, both meeting people in person and, like you said, like having people online, like, oh my God, there's other people that know what this like to do this and that are also pushing themselves, and that there is something really, I think, cool and necessary about having community around the thing that you do or the things that you love. And it's so, that's so baked in with running, which I think it makes it, it's one of the wonderful things about running.
Yep.
So it's funny you said too about Kara Goucher and Shalane Flanagan. I, with the, all the Olympic trials coming up this year, that the track trials are in Eugene, and I'm like waiting every single day checking for when like the day by day tickets go on sale, because I'm not going to go for all 10 days, but it's going to be so fun to go to the Olympic trials.
I'm pretty sure Shalane, she lives in Oregon, isn't she? Portland, I think.
I think she lives in Portland, yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, Olympic year, I don't know. It's pretty exciting. It's interesting too, like since having moved to Bend, that I've met, you know, a good amount of professional runners and pro athletes. This is a place that like people like to train. And it's so funny, you know, me going out and doing my, like, these are my like little goals, or I mean, they're big to me, whatever. And then talking to someone who like their goal is to make the Olympic team. And like, even though the goals are so, so, so different, that the process is very similar. Like everyone can relate to what it is to not want to do something and, you know, do the workout anyway, or to like push yourself to get the best out of yourself. Like those feelings are the same regardless of kind of the status of your goals, which is, I think, one of the bonding things about running.
Yep.
Yeah, I love it. So, okay. So outside of running and Starbucks, what are you totally obsessed with right now?
That's an awesome question. And it's the kind of question that draws skeletons out of the closet, that, you know, the types of, what do you call them? Sins of desire, whatever it is. I have to admit right now, it's Lana Del Rey. I don't know what it is about her. I've always been drawn to, the female voice for some reason, dating back to Sarah McLachlan, who is still my all time favorite singer. And, but for some reason, just the idea of, a creative person who's willing to mold herself, but also be unmolded. And so I've been doing a lot of research and listening to her music and her videos and kind of following her story. Because in a weird way, it serves as inspiration, right? To kind of stay true to yourself and do what you want to do, and not formulate yourself into kind of what you think the world needs versus what you want to be. So outside of that, it's still work. I mean, I'm online all the time. And so for me, it's more a matter of trying to figure out what I want to do and how I want to do it. And as I mentioned to you before the call started, that I'm going to be starting up another podcast. So that'll be another sort of kind of quote unquote new race, right? That we talked about with running, which is something new, but sort of, you know, still within the same thing. Baseball season starting up. So we as a family will be completely inundated with travel baseball for my son. And so those are the types of things that will occupy my mind and our schedules probably for the next 6 months.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned podcasting, and obviously since we are on a podcast, let's talk about podcasting, right? Like how mad can we get? What was your kind of like first foray into podcasting? Was it you were a guest on a show and you were like, ooh, this is fun. Maybe I'm going to do this. Like, how did that kind of work its way into your creative life?
I think I've been, as the guy who founded Studio Press and the premium WordPress theme space, I had been on a number of shows talking about the story. I know Andrew Warner had me on his podcast way back in the day about, you know, how to build a multi-million dollar business in the WordPress space. But for me, it was our company, Rainmaker.fm, was a podcast network we started almost a year ago. And as a partner and as kind of the, one of the bigger personalities within our company, I was pretty much told I was going to have a podcast. And so, you know, I don't love public speaking. I don't love that. I've never been that way. I've never been a stage guy. And so it kind of was ominous for me. But, you know, as a new challenge and journey, I thought, yeah, sure, I'll do it. And so I started the No Sidebar podcast. At the time, it was meant to be a little bit more from the business and kind of entrepreneurial perspective. But it was a struggle. Like I told you earlier, I recorded my first call with Joshua Becker and we talked for like 55 minutes and the quality was bad. And, you know, you don't really understand how you sound until you hear yourself back. In other words, you can't, as you're talking, you don't understand how many times you pause or break or say, or do all those types of things until you actually listen to it. And so it took me probably 3 or 4 hours to try to edit that first show. And that was, it was a complete eye opener. I'm like, this sounds bad. I sound bad. What do I do? I called our producer, Robert Bruce, and I said, I recorded my first show. We haven't even published it yet, and I want to quit. And he's like, what? I'm like, man, like, this is not cut out for this. I just, you know, and I knew that I was partially being overdramatic, but there was a part of me. And so in typical fashion for me, if I'm going to do something, I go in all in. And so I'm like, okay, he had sent me like a cheesy $40 or $50 mic, just to try to get started. And I said, okay, I'm going to take matters into my own hands because that's the kind of guy I am. I like to be in control of stuff. And so I went to Guitar Center and I said, look, speaking of authenticity, I walked in. I said, look, I just recorded my first show. I don't know what I'm doing. I sound terrible. I want to buy the best. Hook me up, right? Salesperson's dream. And so he got me a great Bluebird mic and he showed me some acoustic things and I knew I had some space. So I probably dropped maybe $800-900 on all of this stuff. I went home, I cut all my foam, I put it in this room, I hooked up my mic, I got a amplifier, I did everything. And then I recorded the next call and I was like, okay, now there's hope, right? Because I actually sound decent and I've learned a few things, you know, how to cut tracks in GarageBand and do all of the things that I could produce myself. Maybe it was like the woman who wants to put on makeup, right? I'm like, I have this opportunity to make it seem better than it is. And so I taught myself GarageBand and I cut my first show. I was like, okay, I can do this now. And so I started, I think we did about 20, I think I did 20 shows with the No Sidebar podcast. And it was a struggle. I still have learned a lot of that stuff the hard way. And I even talked about that on a couple of the shows, kind of stopping and saying, hey, look, this is where I'm struggling and all of that. And so I kind of threw in the towel towards the middle of last summer just because the No Sidebar website kind of started to kind of steer away from the business goals. And so it made sense to kind of retire the podcast. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, something when you just said about kind of throwing in the towel or like retiring the podcast, one of my, I don't know, struggles in doing creative things online relates to kind of what I said before about getting bored or wanting new projects. Like I tend to be kind of like you, where if I'm going to do something, I'm so excited, I'm all in, let's do it. And then I don't want to do it anymore, right? And so I think that I have gotten kind of trapped in this idea of, okay, well, if you start something, you have to do that thing forever, which is not true, right? Like that there's like a certain amount of grace of like projects can have end dates. Like just because you start a podcast doesn't mean you have to do a podcast until you die, right? But like there can be, I don't know, I think that that's something that like potentially holds people back from doing things or starting a blog or whatever their thing is. It's like this idea of like, well, I'm going to do this and I'm going to become known for this thing and then I have to do it forever. And so I like hearing your story of like, oh, I just didn't want to do that anymore, you know?
Well, think of television, right? Way back in the day, certain sitcoms were on 52 weeks of the year, right? And if you think now to certain shows, they probably have what seasons now on shows are what 20 episodes long, which means 32 weeks of the year, there's not a new show. And I think that kind of teaches us that there's this thing called a season, right? Where and it's known up front, right? Those who watch the shows, they know the season's going to last 20 episodes. And so when you set up good expectations and when you present it as, hey, we're going to go through a season, much the same that you have here, you've a couple seasons of the show where you kind of, I don't know how you explain it, but you present to them, hey, this isn't going to last forever. I'm going to do a season of the show. We're going to see how it goes. We're going to, that teaches people, one, not to have high expectations, but also that it's okay to break up your life into, a digestible situation where you're not, burdened with stuff and their expectations are normal. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it's like the experimentation mindset, right? Like I thought about starting a podcast and was interested in starting a podcast for like a year and a half before I actually did it. And I know I've shared this story on another episode in one of the first two seasons, but part of the reason that I didn't do it was because the typical podcast model that I saw out there was you basically release like an episode a week, or, some people are doing daily episodes or a couple episodes a week. And like that content creation model of, releasing something every week indefinitely, like for me as a creator, is not within kind of what I just said to you before about like, I'd rather like work for 12 hours this many days in a row and then be done versus, I just have to keep doing this every week forever. And so it held me back for a long time until finally I was like, why don't I do it differently? And I was actually inspired by Netflix, the way that they will release an entire season of their shows, right? Their original shows at one time. And also as a consumer, I love that because I'm like a binge consumer. I like watch the whole season in a day. And so I thought, why don't I just do that with podcasts? And it's been really interesting, like going in, doing the first season as an experiment and the second season, taking a couple months off during the holidays to really think about it and realizing, actually, I love this. This is so much fun if I'm doing it in this like model that I want to do it, where like it's an entire season, it gets released, and then I have a break. And that, and that's not necessarily what would work for everyone, but it's again kind of that like digging into like how do you like to make stuff.
It's funny that you mentioned the binge thing, because I remember 2 years ago when I first got into Downton Abbey, I watched two or three seasons in like a 5-day span, right? And you almost kind of get used to the fact that you can do that. And when I got caught up, I almost went through like a weird depression thing, because I was like, what is this waiting thing I have to do? Can I just click play and watch the next episode? And so, and yes, there are upsides and downsides to that model, right? Apple does that all the time, which is where they talk about their products and they make you wait for it, draws, interest and builds, all that stuff. So I get kind of the business element of making people wait. But I, when you first asked me to be on the show, and I said yes, we went back and forth, and you had said, I'm recording my episodes, in these 2-week spans. It actually lit a fire when I was approached to potentially start another podcast. And I said, one of the things that I learned last season or on the first show, what is my process was every Monday I would wake up and say, okay, who's going to be on my show this week? And okay, crap, now it's Wednesday. I got to record something and edit it quickly because it's the end of the week. And that was very stressful to not have anything planned out. It was literally a week to week type of thing. And when I heard you say, I'm going to record all my things, I thought, hey, maybe that's a different way to approach this podcast if I do start it, which is plan it all out ahead of time and then easily execute because you have a map in which to go.
Yeah, I mean, I work not just with the podcast, but in general, I do really well with like batch work, right? And so this model of, okay, I've said that it's coming out February 1st, I need to get all of the audio to Adam, the guy who does my, all of my audio editing and stuff like that by, X date in order for him to have time to turn it around and get it back to me so that I can get it published. Okay, well, that means this is the time frame in which I'm recording. And it's really helpful for me that pretty much I'm doing nothing else during this time period. Like obviously maintenance things on some other projects and stuff, but like I work well being like, my focus is on this podcast. So like, this is what's happening. And also like that it's, I think it leaves like less back and forth with like potential guests. Like this is the time frame. If this doesn't work for you, that's totally cool. I'll ask someone else. But like it gives someone like a really easy thing to say yes or no to, which is helpful too. So, but again, I mean, it's all any of these processes. It's just, you kind of like make it up from scratch, right? Like I have no idea what other people do outside of, the handful of podcasts that I've been a guest on. And it's just like, okay, well, what worked for me as a guest? What didn't? What experience am I trying to create for these people that are gonna, give me 2 hours of their time, which is like not an insubstantial amount of time,
Yeah.
So what's the new podcast that you want to create or that you're thinking about? What's next?
Well, we can cut this one out because I've purposely tried not to, or maybe we leave this in. Maybe this is the good, the stuff that people would want to hear. Internally, we have talked about a podcast that I'm going to start possibly for the company. Externally, I'm saying nothing about it because if I do, I'll get questions, I'll get people asking when, and all of the things that typically kind of work their way into the psyche of me and trying to perform for people and meet expectations. And what I want to do, as I mentioned earlier, I want to have things set up ahead of time rather than, you know, feel the heat to get something done and out there because now people are expecting it. So
I know
what this podcast is. I know what it's going to be about. I think it'll be good and great for our audience and probably pretty expected, but I don't want to say what it is yet just because in this case, I don't want to do the Apple thing where I build apprehension and all that stuff because that will mess me up in my own way. And so I want to do it on my own time. And so when I'm ready and I have things planned and some shows recorded, then we'll make the announcement because then I don't have to do a bunch of work to get it done because it'll already be done.
No, that, I mean, that's awesome. I actually want to talk about this more. I read something a couple of years ago, don't remember where or from who, so clearly not giving any credit because I don't remember, but it was something about that the one of the problems kind of with social media or just this like very real time, like blah, 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 here's all my thoughts and feels, here's what I'm working on, that like the potential downside of that is that we don't give our creative projects the incubation time that sometimes they need. And it was talking about how like a lot of the gratification of doing something comes from like other people's response or other people's feedback sometimes. And that if you like leak things out too early or you talk about it too much before you've done anything, then and you get the feedback and people are all excited, that it's almost deflating because you're like, well, I already got this positive feedback. Like, why am I now going to go do the thing? Or it was, I don't know, it was just like an interesting discussion of that there's something to be said for like keeping things to yourself until you're ready to let them out.
Yeah, I would agree with that. As a creative, I spend a lot of time on Dribbble, which is a kind of a showcasing of design. And I do leak things out quite a bit more from a not authenticity, because that's not really right. But I like to just share stuff. I'm an oversharer. I think this is cool. So I share it possibly to get some stroke back. But one of the things that I've done is I'll share everything and 80% of what I do ends up on the cutting room floor. But the problem is that 80% is still wanted by the people. And so I get emailed all the time from people saying, hey, and they'll throw me links and they'll show, hey, you were working on this. You got me all excited about this. How come you never released it? Well, because I'm a creative and then I stopped liking it or it went another direction. And I kind of have to do that. And I realize that you kind of mislead people almost in a way when you leak some of this stuff, because not all of this stuff comes out and or it's not available for the people who want it. And so you have a small tendency to create, I wouldn't say negative, but you kind of let people down in a sense because they think that something's coming. And then when it doesn't, then there's that, oh, was I misled or was I baited? Or, you know, you kind of go through all of that. So I do walk a fine line between what I share, what I don't share. And I usually share stuff I know for a fact will make its way out to the floor.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is really interesting too. It goes back to what you said about expectations, right? Like if as creatives we're setting up the expectation app, I'm happy to share a lot of what I'm working on, but like, by the way, a lot of this stuff won't actually happen, right? There's like a little bit of a different expectation game being played there. But I think, you know, this is something that I struggle with because I'm very extroverted and very committed to kind of this life philosophy of real talk and like sharing real life in real time. Like there's a lot in that that like very much resonates with me, kind of as opposed to the, you know, wait 2 years and then put a really nice bow on the story and like tell it then. Not to say that we can't, you know, also tell stories from the past, but I think there's something that comes out when you're talking about what's happening in real time before you've like quote figured it out. And that works really well for me. That's kind of like how I naturally operate. But sometimes when it comes to creative projects, like that strategy winds up backfiring. So I guess I'm sharing this just as like, that's something that I'm working on is trying to with certain creative projects, like keep them more to myself until, like you said, like, you know, that it has legs or you know, that it's something that you want to share. And I think when it comes to this value of like living authentically or it still is like a fine line. Like it's fine to keep stuff to yourself. Like I think sometimes people associate like living authentically with like, okay, you know, my life's on camera 24/7. You get access to all the things, but like you can live authentically while still keeping stuff to yourself, I think.
You know, I do agree with that, but I will also say, I think there's something to be said about the idea of outtakes and how people like almost to a point where they'd be willing to buy stuff that's not fully produced. And by that, I mean, Someone hit me on Twitter the other day. I made a comment about how I was forking my own design to start another design. So, you know, basically insinuating an unfinished product. And this person says, would you ever consider setting up a membership site, basically putting all your cutting room floor available to anybody who wanted to come in and take it? And I, as much as what you said is true and what I said leading up to that was true, there is a weird, and this maybe goes into like super fandom and things like that, where people will buy anything you want or do or use or produce. But I've often thought to myself, you know, would there be a market for, you know, the unfinished, the unpolished stuff of what I do? I mean, obviously I don't sell it now because I'm a partner in a company and we just produce and, you know, make available the finished stuff. But I always wonder, I'm like, should I just leave a door open and just say, hey, all of the stuff that never got done anything with is here for your taking, and see what the response from that would be.
Totally. I mean, and I think the response would be awesome. Like that's, I mean, one of the reasons that I love this conversation is, first of all, there's no right answer to anything, right? And I think mm-hmm. that inherently what we're both saying is that like people are definitely curious about the process. Like I know, like I'm like such a voyeur. On that's honestly one of the main reasons that I started this podcast is I was like, I just want to like talk to people and figure out like, what did you do this morning? Like, what'd you eat? What are you reading? Like, I'm just like so curious how other people like actually live their lives. And so I think, yeah, there's something like inherently like very interesting about other people's stuff. And that could come in the form of, like you said, like unfinished, you know, editing room floor stuff in certain industries, or it could be just honest conversations about, you know, the behind the scenes process with people, you know, who are in other industries. Because I think certain types of creative work lead themselves to showing unfinished projects more easily than others. But it's still this idea of like, okay, like what's going on behind the scenes, and like letting people into that as much as, I think as much as it makes sense and as much as you're comfortable, but also in as much as it doesn't get in the way of your own work. So I think that's kind of like what I'm struggling with is sometimes if I like give things too much hype or too much air when it's just like a little baby seed idea, that can get in the way of determining if I actually want to work on it as opposed to getting too swayed by what other people think. Or, you know, it's like balancing letting people in and being authentic in real time with like doing whatever you need to do to kind of like nurture your creativity.
Yeah. And that circles back to the question you asked about the podcast, which is, you know, what is that going to be? And just like you said, I don't want to talk about it because if I talk about it, then I'll open myself up to all of the things you just said, which is, you know, people being interested, people asking questions, people doing all of these things that would immediately accelerate the process of which I'm trying to purposely slow down.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but I think that takes like a certain amount of awareness, right? Of like, obviously you've created a lot of things now to get to this point of, okay, like maybe I can be a little bit slower and a little more intentional and like recognizing what you need in order to make, you know, X project a reality. And that's not going to be the same for every project.
Yeah, I agree.
So speaking of kind of real-time curiosity, voyeuristic questions, what are you reading right now? Or what have you read lately that's been really interesting for you?
So now that we're being authentic with each other, I don't read much at all. It's been a long time since I've read a full book. I've never been a reader, which hurt me in high school. But that's how it goes. I was able to work my way through that. I like to do the short digestible stuff. So I do a lot of blog stuff, reading of blogs, posts, because that's easy. My attention span is usually never super awesome. And so reading a 1,000, 1,500 word post, that I can do, and I can get out of that when I need to. So I don't read books much. I wish I was a reader. Sometimes I wish my wife Shelley can read a book in like an afternoon, and I sometimes challenge her and say, there's no way you read that whole book. And she's like, I sure did. And so sometimes I get into the imposter syndrome where I'll go buy a book and I'll say to myself, I'm going to be a book reader. And then I'm going to sit down and like a chapter in, I'm like, oh my God, just pull my hair out. You know, tech magazines, Fast Company, Inc., Entrepreneur, that kind of stuff, things that more or less are short but inspiring, blog posts. I do a lot of reading for curation concepts within No Sidebar, other people's blogs, so that I can share on our Facebook page. I'm going to be going back through a season where I spend a tremendous amount of my time on Studio Press, one of our lines of business. And so I'm very purposely going to be digesting a lot about design so that we can, I can use it to learn, I can use it to share, stuff like that. So
I'm obsessed with this entire answer, to be honest. Like I love because it's that's like not the an answer that I hear much, that people are like, yeah, I'm like not really a reader, but I love that. Like, I love the, I don't know, it's, it feels like from your answer that you know yourself well. Like, no, this is just like not super enjoyable for me, so I don't do it. I don't know. I love that.
Yep.
Okay. Go ahead. Yeah, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, I'm a music listener. I know that's a, it's a, it's almost an excuse answer, but I don't get inspired by reading books or anything like that. I get inspired by music, and maybe it's more of like an ethereal thing where, you know, I close my eyes and then I can find the inspiration. But I'm less, you know, type A, more type B. And so I'm more of a feeler. And so for me, music is like, what are you listening to? That's for me, that type of question that I can answer. So anyway, go ahead.
Interesting. No, I love that because I'm exactly the opposite. Like, it's, I don't want to say that I don't like music because that's like a weird thing to say, but it's more that I don't care. Like, I'm not really aware of anything that's going on. You know, I don't know what's new. Like, I know the things that I like have in iTunes that I like listening to while running, right? Which is like real poppy or like hip hop type stuff. Like that connection that you described, like about Lana Del Rey, and that I've, you know, heard you say about other singers and musicians and stuff, whatever that kind of emotional thing is, like, I definitely don't have that. Whereas it sounds like I'm a lot like your wife. Like, I can read a book in an afternoon. I'm usually reading like 4 to 6 books at a time, like well over 100 books a year. Like, I love reading. So it's so interesting to, it's so interesting to talk to someone who's like basically the exact opposite of that. It's so funny. So what are you listening to right now then?
Lots of Lana Del Rey. She has 3 albums, and I binge listen to music. I get it, you know, give me about 2 weeks with somebody, and by that time I'm ready to just punch the album, and because I'm listened to it for literally 3 weeks straight. So a lot of her, you know, I go through, I've lived a very long and interesting life where I've gone through various seasons of life, which have brought me through various musical seasons of life. While back I was in the country music thing. And so I'll go through seasons where I go back to wanting to listen to the music I listened to back then. Grunge is another era that I get caught up in. I went through, I don't know, about 6 months ago, really deep grunge music where I pulled down all the Pearl Jam and Nirvana stuff and just will listen to nothing but that for, you know, weeks or months at a time. And it's kind of in like a transitional season. I think that's why this Lana Del Rey thing has really popped up, is like, it's been kind of the crutch that I've been listening to her stuff, trying to figure out what the next season is, but just all kinds of music. Podcasts, I'm trying to listen to more, so I can learn because it's not reading, but I can hear it, and two, so that I can use that for said potential podcast that we talked about.
Right, said mystery podcast. I love it.
Exactly.
How does music kind of factor into your like work or creative process? Do you listen to music like while writing, while designing? Is there like a certain kind of like setup that you need in order to get your best work done?
You know, I'm online for off and on, like between 6 a.m. and basically midnight. And when I'm not downstairs in the kitchen, like during family-ish time when, you know, so basically either when they're all asleep or they're, you know, at work or at school or whatever, I have music on, unless if I'm on a call, but music is on all the time. It's background noise to a point. It's also, I almost don't know if I could create without music being on, much the same way that I am with running, where I would die if I had to go out and run a half marathon without listening to anything. And so I will not sign up for races that state, you know, because sometimes for safety reasons, they say you can't use a headset or anything like that. And I won't even sign up for that race because I know that that would be a disaster for me. So it's almost like I need it. Not specifically what I listen to, but just the fact that it's there.
That's so interesting. My husband's like that, where he'll just like, he has, you know, these big headphones and they're on all the time because we both work from home, and he wants music on all the time forever. And I want music on basically no time ever. It's like, we really don't fight, but that's like one of the only things that comes up when, you know, I'm cooking dinner and he's like, please, can I put music on? Or I'm like this terrible wife. I'm like, I hate music. I never want it on. But for whatever reason, it's like really distracting for me. Like I can't get work done unless it's like basically complete silence. And it's so funny because he's like completely the opposite. And with running, I listen to music a lot, and or, you know, podcasts, audiobooks and stuff during training runs. But when racing, like, absolutely can't listen to anything, because it's almost like music like tunes me out of myself too much, which is really good for like, I guess, pain and boredom avoidance. But when I'm trying to get the best out of myself, I feel like I need to be more tuned in, and that can only happen in silence, which, full circle, epiphany live on the air. Maybe that's why I don't listen to anything while I'm writing, because it's like the most tuned into myself. I don't know. That's interesting though, to explore that.
So, well, sometimes we need background noise. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. You know, sometimes that was me giving myself the 2 seconds I'm supposed
to. No, I love it. Real talk. See, we're just excited. Yes. We want to talk all over each other. No, it's all good. Go ahead. So background noise, go.
If I was cutting this podcast, I would take that and use that as the intro to the podcast as the outtake. No, I was going to say, I'm a background noise person. People ask all the time, how do you work at Starbucks with all of that commotion going on and people, and, you know, do you ever get distracted? And I'm like, believe it or not, I'm less distracted in the middle of Starbucks with 100 people walking around and with music going on in my ears than if I were to be like in a room like you with everything turned off. I would, the silence would breed distraction for me. So it's interesting how we're just, you know, wired differently.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, and so you mentioned Starbucks, right? And I know, I don't really know where your love of Starbucks comes from. All I know from following you on Instagram and stuff, that there is a lot of Starbucks. You are the Starbucks guy. Where was that, just kind of like an organic, hey, this is, I like to work here, I like this coffee. Like, where did the Starbucks obsession come from?
You know, I don't know. I've always liked coffee. I was a Gloria Jeans guy back in the day, like way back in the day. And then somewhere along the way, I started going to Starbucks. And then I think it, probably not until like the internet days when I started being online, did I realize that it could potentially be used as a source of personal branding. It sounds weird, but I'm 80% Starbucks real fan, and maybe 10-20% of it is, there's a play on it, right? Which is, you kind of present yourself a certain way, and then you get the stigma where people, you know, you'll see tweets where people will say, hey, I'm hanging out at Starbucks channeling my inner B. Gardner. And you kind of get this, okay, now it's sort of like a, I wouldn't say it's an act, but it's a label, the Starbucks guy. And so I've been known as the quote unquote Starbucks addict, because I put that as the title on my website, and it's fun to rank in Google for Starbucks addict. In fact, it led me to an interview on ABC. And when I asked, how did you get my name? She said, I Googled Starbucks addict, and there you were. So, you know, it's fun. It's kind of like a fun little dress up and be the Starbucks guy type of thing. And I do like the coffee. I love the atmosphere and just the whole idea of working from home and those cases, working at Starbucks, because it's a privilege to be able to do that.
I mean, definitely. It's funny, though, the kind of snowball effect of, you know, you say something a certain number of times, and then people begin to associate you with that thing, and then they send you links about that thing. Or like, it's interesting, the evolution of like how we become known for something. Like, and I, as someone who has gone through like a lot of different like seasons of obsessions, and like this idea of obsession is like very attractive to me, like that I'm either like, yes, I love this, let's do this all the time, or I don't give a shit about this at all. Like, that tends to be the way that my brain works. And there was a period of time, this is a really random story, but when I first got into running and I was listening to audiobooks, I wound up listening to the Twilight books, right? Stephanie Meyer's Twilight series, which I had never read, like, you know, the 7 years ago when they came out, when everyone was really into them. And I thought, I was going through so many audiobooks, and I was like, ugh, I keep having to decide what I want to listen to. And somewhere along the way, Twilight popped up as one of like the suggestions on Audible where I get my books from. And I thought, okay, if I don't hate this, then my next 4 books are sets. Like, let me just give this a chance. And I thought, like, I would kind of listen to it, I would kind of make fun of it. Dude, I got so into it. Like, I couldn't believe how much I loved these Twilight books, to the point where when I was done with them, I then wound up reading, I'd say maybe 8, maybe 10 books of essays and like critical essays, like about Twilight, like trying to figure out like why I love this so much. And like during that period of time, I became known to like everyone as like, this is the girl who's obsessed with Twilight. So I would get like weird stuff in the mail, and like all these links. And I don't know, just like funny how you become known as something, even still, like something will come out about Twilight and people want to talk to me about it.
I mentioned guilty pleasures earlier, and I will confess to you across all of the podcast world, back when that was going down, the Twilight thing, I was a huge Twihard. I could not stop watching it was like the Downton Abbey thing, where I think I started liking it right after the second one, New Moon, came out. And so I watched the first two like 100 times. And then I was one of those, oh my God, now I got to wait a year for the next one to come out. And of course, I had to go through 3 more of those because there was 5 in total, but I almost felt weird. Like I almost didn't like to admit or say anything. Somebody roasted me on Twitter. It may have been Brian Clark, my the CEO of our company. He said, dude, you cannot admit that you watch Twilight in social media because I may have to fire you.
That's hilarious. Wait, okay, so clearly we're going to talk about this. Have you read the books or did you just watch the movies?
No, I don't do books. But I don't know how. I think I was going to on a flight and I was like, all right, I'm just going to watch, kind of probably the same thing with you in the book. I'm like, I'm just going to watch the movie just to see what all the fuss is about. And as a person who loves culture and loves like the younger crowd, the generational thing, I'm like, okay, let me see what this is all about. And so I watched the first one and I don't know why, but man, I just got hooked like a shark. And I was like, this is like the thing. And I kind of, maybe after the third or fourth movie, when I realized that, okay, it's coming to an end. Now things are starting to get a little bit, okay, redundant kind of within all of it. I lost it. But when I was in the middle of it, I think I watched it every night for like 2 weeks straight one time.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Also, I mean, yes, I get it. You don't do books. The books are so much better than the movies. I know that that's like often the case. If you ever feel the need to get back into the Twilight situation without reading it, the audiobooks are so good and so well narrated. Like, I think that was part of why I got so obsessed. Like, because I read so much and I think I'm probably a pretty fast reader, like I would have read those books in like a day, but because I was listening to them, right, and I would only let myself listen to them while running, because this was back when I was like a new runner and like really needed kind of every motivation to get myself to do it. And I got so into the books and I was like, well, you can only listen to them if you're running, and then I'd be so excited to go running. And so they spent, like, I wound up listening to them for, you know, to get through the whole series. It was like months, right? So it was like a huge part of my life, like in my ears for like months. And yeah, that's part of how I got into it. But that's hilarious that you were also into Twilight. See, yeah. Things that come out on podcasts that you would not have known.
That's right.
Okay, so I want to time travel and I want you to tell me about your very first job.
Very first job, which is interesting because it led to all of the other ones. When I was in high school, after school, you know, 4 to 7, 4 to 8, those type of hours, I worked at a local convenience store here in Chicago called White Hen Pantry. And it wasn't like a 7-Eleven, even though everybody said, oh, you work at a 7-Eleven. I'm like, no, it's not a 7-Eleven. And so I worked there for a couple years just after school as like the teenager kid that took out the trash and stocked the shelves and so on. And after high school, I went to college and basically, I wouldn't say failed out, but I just didn't know what I wanted to do. So I stopped going to college and I called my boss back and said, hey, look, I'm coming back in town. I don't know if I'm going to go to school next year or ever. Can I get my job back? And so they hired me back as a manager. And so I kind of graduated from, you know, stock boy to manager because I'd been there so long and I knew what I was doing. And so they hired me as manager. It was a full-time job at that point. And from there, I learned a couple of really huge life lessons, one of which was the idea of customer service. So we were located in a family neighborhood, and so we had a lot of customers that came in on a regular basis. And so I got to know them by name, the types of things that they would buy or what they would want. And so I would consider a lot of those people that at the time I was friends with. And so I learned from my boss just the importance of taking care of people and customer service. And through all of that, one of our customers one day slid me his business card and he said, just give me a call. I know you're at work. Just give me a call. And so I called him. I was like, curious what he wanted. He says, look, man, I've known you for a couple years now. I really think you're a great kid and I have a position within my company that I have to fill. And I don't even know if you're qualified for it from a qualification standpoint, but from a character standpoint, I feel like I have to hire you. And so I worked at that job. It was a project manager for an architectural firm for 10 years. And in that 10 years, I taught myself, this was right kind of in the early .com era, like mid, late 90s, when kind of the internet and all that stuff was happening. I taught myself a lot about computers because I was never self-trained. And so one of the things I would do while I was there, admittedly, was blogging. I blogged kind of in and around some time I had there. And so that's when I got into WordPress. And so kind of out of boredom at some point, I taught myself WordPress, how to design and do all that stuff. And that's ultimately what paved the way to the StudioPress company that I formed, which in turn merged itself into CopyBlogger Media. So, you know, going back to the first job, there was a progression of how they were related. And I don't know if I would be here, you know, doing what I'm doing today if I hadn't followed that path. I mean, we never know really, but But it was a good experience. You know, I was one of those kids that had to work through high school versus, you know, play sports or do other things. And I don't ever look back on that as a bad thing. I think I learned a lot of stuff, even at that early age about, you know, business in general, which to this day still comes to the surface.
So, yeah, it's so interesting to me, like the evolution of people's careers or kind of like how one experience leads to another, especially in light of like, we really just never know what's the fit, right? Like you couldn't ever have predicted, hey, this guy's going to come in and give me his business card. And then that's going to be like the next 10 years of my life and the breeding ground for me to learn this other thing. Like I actually find that to there's like a lot of hope and optimism in that for me of like, we like might think we can like plan and figure out and like control all the things, but like we have no idea like what opportunities like could come our way.
And I also think that, and for me in this case, who knows what would have happened if I had said no, right? Because I was comfortable in my job, even though it was a lot of hours and it wasn't really great work, but I had no idea what I would be doing, but I took that risk, right? Because for some reason, the idea of doing something in an office was better at the time than in retail. And so I look back and say to myself, wow, what would have happened if I would have turned him down or said no or never called him? Would I have still been in there? And where would my life have been there? Would I be this, you know, internet entrepreneur guy? Would I have followed that path still in another way? And so I think that there are times where we, you know, those chances we take, the risks that we take really open up like a complete set of doors that you would just never expect.
Have you found that kind of either the more success or the more comfort that you get that it's become harder to take risks?
100% yes. If you have show notes, I can give you a link to this. This guy, John O'Nolan, wrote a post, a very authentic, like one of the most authentic things I've ever read online about what happens to people when they get in the limelight and, you know, when the risks and the stakes at which those risks, they completely paralyze you into not doing all of the things that got you to that place to begin with. And so yeah, I mean, and not that I'm by any stretch, you know, a popular guy online. I have a decent sized following. I'm not a Chris Brogan or anybody like that. But I have a big enough audience to where the size of that audience definitely on a daily basis dictates things I do and don't do and things I say and don't say.
Yeah, I think about that a lot, like about, I think I have a fear of getting trapped into like any one set of expectations or like, because I'm definitely someone who like, I mean, I've gone through like tons of different kind of URLs and iterations of like myself and like the creative work and stuff that I do, that I like get worried about reaching a point where for any reason, like the trap of success or whatever, that I no longer feel like I have the freedom, and I guess these are all just like self-imposed things, but the freedom to like pivot and change and grow. And as just, you know, curiosity, since that's something that I struggle with, like, has that ever come up for you where you feel like stuck in the things that have made you successful?
Yeah, I think, you know, being a part of a bigger company now has definitely meant the stuff that I produce has to be more polished. It has to be more tested and it has to go through a process by which the larger audience as a whole would consume it and make sure things don't break and all of that. And so, you know, even over the last couple of years, I've thought to myself, man, sometimes I just wish I could go back where I would just create something one night, release it the next day, and kind of not necessarily go by these rules or legalistic kind of things that are now in place. And, you know, I think all the time, as much as I love the success and I love, you know, and someone likes or follows me on Twitter, and there's that degree of ego stroke, and I think that's appropriate and okay. But like, I can't imagine, you know, being like a real celebrity. I don't like I. As much as people wish they could be, you know, whoever, you know, Shakira, or, like these people, they get stalked. They can't have dinner without being asked for interviews. I have no idea, and I get why so many of them fall off the wagon and they get depressed and they bury themselves in the stuff that they do, because I cannot imagine having that much success with that much pressure. Because even in our own little online world, you know, I feel that to a point where I kind of go through seasons of these little depressive funks and I'm like, man, if I was in Hollywood, this would be like a millionfold.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, I have no desire to be famous. That sounds terrible. So I'm curious, you mentioned, you know, while you were working at that architecture firm that, you know, you were kind of teaching yourself WordPress. What was kind of like, if we're like zooming in on that, like how do you go from, oh, I think I'm going to teach myself how to use this thing to then essentially building like an entire business around it? Like what was the trajectory of that like?
So back then it was really, I was WordPress back in the day, everything was free. The themes were free, all of that. And so as I was blogging part personally, but also kind of blogging about like my experiences with WordPress and, you know, hey, I'm starting to build some stuff. I kind of entered kind of creative mode back then. I was in writing big time back then, but design for me was a new kind of passion, a new way to do something that was, I don't know, expressive. And so I really enjoyed the idea of kind of designing stuff. And the only way for me to do that was to do it by trial and error because I didn't go to school for design or anything like that. And so, you know, I would just literally try things and see how they would look on the web and then go backwards or hit delete or undo or whatever. And so what happened was I would create these free themes. And then I thought, okay, well, back in that day, it was distribute them, let people download them for free and to see what happens. And, you know, the big thing for WordPress theme people back then was you could put a link in the bottom of that designed by Brian Gardner, which would be a link back to my website. And so I thought, hey, this is a distribution method to which I can get more people to my website, which ultimately from a business perspective was building an audience. Mm-hmm. And so I built an audience of people who were interested in what I was doing with WordPress. And so I was doing free themes and people would download them. And then every once in a while, I'd get someone who would email me and say, hey, I downloaded your theme. I like it. Can I pay you to tweak a few things? And so it started as a very early sort of moonlighting gig where I would, you know, customize things for a few $100 here or there, which at the time was spending money. And I had a real estate guy from Boston who I will always go on record as never giving the name because I feel like if you ever found out what he did in my life, he would come back for royalties. And so I say that in tongue in cheek, but there's a part of me that actually believes that somewhere along the way he could. Anyway, so I created a real estate design and for him in WordPress, and it was actually more than what he wanted. And so he, in theory, rejected it. And I thought it was like groundbreaking and it was pushing the limitations of WordPress. And so I went on my blog and said, would anybody buy this? Hundreds of comments. People say, yes, that's awesome. I would buy it in a heartbeat. I need that for my company or my business or whatever. And as a guy who didn't go through any type of schooling for business, I wasn't naive. I realized there was an opportunity here. And so I followed up that blog post with how much would you spend on a premium WordPress theme? And so the range was $50 to $100. And so I was like, I have hundreds of people who claim, I mean, who knows if they will, who claim that they would buy something from me for $50 to $100 a piece. And I was like, wow, this sounds like an opportunity. And so I created the first theme called Revolution, put it for sale. And the first month, I sold $10,000 worth, the second month, 20, the third month, 40, the fourth month, 80. And it was at that point I realized I had something special.
That's insane. I love hearing that story, but like that's such a, what I would say, like very quick growth, right? That like kind of like an explosive, like right talent, right place, right time.
Yeah, that's exactly what people ask me all the time, the story. And, you know, what would you say to people trying to get in the space now? And I was like, you know, I was lucky more than I was good at that point. Like I did the right thing at the right time. I was the only one doing it. Competition, of course, came quickly, and so I had to deal with that. But it was a complete and total, just what we call the accidental entrepreneur, where it was, you know, I didn't set out to go leave my company so that I could go do this or any of that stuff. But very quickly, it got to a point where I realized, as I told my wife, I said, it's financially irresponsible for me to stay in my day job and not follow this path.
Were you guys married at the time?
We were married and she was working full time and we had two at the time. And so at the time it was, we wanted her to stay home with him. Right. And so, but it made sense for me to quit first so that I could really foster and take this business to another level. And so not only did I have to have the conversation with her, which is, hey, this is our deal, but I also had to say, I know you want to quit, but I think I need to quit first, which of course bred its own, interesting conversations. But so I quit and she quit probably 2 or 3 months later. So it totally worked out and all of that. But it was definitely a wild ride.
So in kind of that early time, right, where you like had such quick growth, there was probably a lot of like learning curves and stuff. Like what sticks out to you when you think back to that time of, ooh, maybe I wish I would have done that differently. Or if I could go back and talk to myself, you know, at that point, here's the advice I would give or something along those lines.
It was the cease and desist letter I got from a company in the United Kingdom that claimed the Revolution WordPress theme software was infringing on their trademark. And I knew nothing about business. I just named it Revolution because I thought that'd be a fun thing. I'm revolutioning WordPress, and I just did it. And so the lesson I learned back then, which of course has kept me in tune to all kinds of business decisions I've made along the way, is you have to prepare yourself for the possibility that what you do or what you're starting might become something, because it's hard to go back when you've already launched a brand, a line of business or whatever, and then all of a sudden you have to say, oops, my bad, I got to rename it something now, because I had no idea what I was doing. And, you know, I took the letter to an intellectual property attorney. He's like, they got total ground, so you might want to change the name. And I'm like, no, I just started this. I quit my job, and now I'm going to, you know, of course, everything back then was a soap opera. And so I thought, okay, there goes the demise of Brian Gardner now. And thankfully, when you build a strong brand, people will follow you regardless. And so I rebranded to Studio Press. I did, in fact, run the name by my lawyer to make sure that that name was okay, and he said it was good. And so from there, that's where Studio Press, story Studio Press.
Yeah, I love that, because this idea, it's so easy when we start something, whether it's because we, you know, are protecting our egos or we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, to think, oh, this is going to be no big thing. This is just my little hobby. This is just, and like, if it is, that's totally fine. But I love what you said about like preparing for the possibility that like something really does take off. And that's, it's like triggering something for me, because I don't really do that. I'm just like, oh, I'm going to name this what I'm going to name it. I'm going to go for it. But like, I have no idea. Like, I never ran it by anyone. But that's a really good point. That's like, okay, well, what if all of the best possible case scenarios come true and you have this like big explosive thing? Like, are you ready for that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay, so at what point did it become more than just you, where you were either like, I'm going to hire someone else, I'm going to partner with someone else? Like, when did that decision come into play?
You know, I was, many years ago, we participated in an event called the Breast Cancer 3-Day, which is a 3-day walk over 60 miles. And I was in a tent on a Friday night, and I was activating forum account subscriptions from my phone after having walked 20 miles. And I realized in that moment, I said, this is not right. I was completely spent, and I had so much I needed to do. And I said, I need to hire somebody, because this is the most ridiculous thing that I'm here doing what I should be doing on a Monday morning, or having someone else do. And so that was like the first moment where I realized it was to a point where it was too much for me to handle all on my own. And once it got to a point where I realized that my skills were on the creative side of things and the less the administrative side of things, I realized that I could potentially be doing more damage, even though the idea of hiring someone or paying someone to do work, I was selfish. I didn't want to spend any money at the time. But I realized kind of it would serve as an investment to the bigger picture, and that I needed to kind of protect my sanity, whatever you want to call it, my spirit, by offloading some of the stuff that I did not want to do and entrusting that with someone else.
So what, once you made that realization, what was your next steps? Like, what did you do to actually, okay, I'm going to hire someone, make this a reality?
You know, it was easy. We had a support forum where some people were kind of standing out as just really good community people, people that wanted to help, and people who had on the side said, hey, if you need any help, let me know, type of stuff. So there was already kind of a group of, you know, people, prospects or whatever for me to reach out to. And there were one or two people in particular that I really probably blindly trusted, but you know, really seemed to be on board what I was doing, and so everybody that I paid to do work or hired kind of came within my ecosystem as people who, you know, brand evangelists, people who believed in what I was doing, people who understood how I built it and all of that. And so it was easy to say, okay, you're going to be the director of support, or you're going to be, you know, my email person or whatever it became. And so it's basically just homegrown.
I mean, it sounds like the kind of thread that I'm hearing come through, like a lot of your story, is this kind of like trusting your gut, right? But from like teaching yourself the design to like making these kinds of decisions. Does that tend to be your decision-making process? Kind of like, what does my gut think? Or Do you do a lot of like research about stuff on the side? Like, what's that balance look like for you?
Yeah, it's 100% gut. I jokingly with my wife, Shelley, she's a book person and I'm a street person. I'm street smart where, and I think, you know, in my own fun way, I'm always like, well, being street smart is actually better than being book smart because as we know now, sometimes going to school doesn't necessarily mean anything once you get out of it. So I've always been, you know, hands-on, under the hood, street smart, because I think you learn, at least I do, and of course, everyone has their own learning methods. But I learned so much more than, you know, putting something together. The first thing I do is open the box and throw the manual away and then try to build it. So sometimes, yes, that gets me into trouble. You get halfway done and realize the piece you missed at the very beginning was clearly communicated as something that you should have done. But that's just how I learn. I like to go with my gut and just do what feels right. Sometimes that's good. Sometimes that's bad. I think you need to, you know, use personal experience as a way to kind of help gauge those. So you're not, you know, as a feeler, it sometimes gets me into trouble because I'm like, I really want to do this or do it this way. And I think in the back of my mind, I shouldn't, but because I'm feeling it too much, I'll err that way. But it's completely that way for me.
How has that been now, you know, like you said, being kind of part of a larger company, having other people involved that, you know, might not make decisions in the same way that you do? Like, has there ever been a time or a situation where, you know, what you wanted to do with your kind of like gut instinct was not the same as what everyone else wanted to do?
I think that we have a good checks and balances system. Because I'm a partner, I can make things happen more my way than, like, in other words, curb the process a little bit. Or have more influence on what happens. But because I built what I did, there's just a lot of entrustment that I've been given within the company. Like, hey, Brian built Studio Press. He knows what he's doing. Let's just kind of, you know, let him pave the way. And as we head into 2016, as we are, you know, I've got a whole slew of ideas of things that I want to do to help grow that line of business. And I'm looking forward to it. And as much as we have to go through kind of a QA process, and as long as I realize there are certain things that need to go through that, as long as I can continue to execute on my ideas, whether or not that means I follow through all of them or by myself or with the help of others kind of in a process that sometimes might make me feel uncomfortable, I'm good with that because big picture, I trust, you know, the big ideas. And just the execution may look a little different.
Yeah, totally. So I'm curious, either now or, you know, like looking back to kind of when you were first coming up as a designer, were there any mentors or role models, whether it's people you knew personally or kind of like following their career and their, you know, work online that were helpful for you?
You know, not really. The early days of WordPress, there were a couple of peers that I would say weren't necessarily role models from like a you know, Obi-Wan and Luke Skywalker kind of thing. But we were more peers, and so we were kind of doing it together. Corey Miller, name of the guy from my friend from iThemes, he would be considered one of those people that we kind of just paved the way together. You know, once we got past that, obviously Brian Clark, who came alongside and asked if I wanted to merge Studio Press into the bigger company. You know, I've always looked up to him as the, you know, I don't call him the godfather of the company, but the guy who you know had built the company to where it was at. And so there's always a degree of trust I have with him, and to help, you know, as CEO of our company, that's just the nature of how we're built as partners, is you trust your CEO, right? And, you know, so there's him. From a design perspective, there's a handful of designers in the community. Bill Kenny from a company called Focus Lab. He's been kind of, I wouldn't call it a mentor, but like an unspoken mentor, right? People that just maybe serve more as inspiration versus a, you know, ongoing, we talk all the time relationship. Tony Clark, probably the biggest example of a mentor. He's another partner in our company. He's the guy I go to all the time. He's who I consider my brother within the company, the guy that I share stuff with and my ideas and things like that. And then there's another guy, one of my better friends, Daryl Vesterfelt, who's also, you know, he's more of like the best friend type in my life, the guy that we share all the junk and things. Like, we don't ever talk about the good things in life because we're so busy, you know, living within the mess and trying to help each other figure out our messes. You know, so there's guys I have set up in my life that have, you know, really been helpful. From a no sidebar standpoint, Joshua Becker clearly would be the mentor. I've modeled a lot of the stuff I do off of what he's done. So I consider him a good friend. So I've got a good group of guys, good support group that are surrounding me.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it sounds like it too. I'm curious, maybe this is projecting a little bit because this has been kind of my experience of spending a lot of time online or, you know, creating and living online. Do you ever find yourself falling into either like jealousy or comparison trap with what either, you know, how people are living their lives or what other designers are doing? Is that something that ever comes up for you?
You know, not so much how they're living their lives, because I have a good living. I earn a decent wage, and I'm very happy with the stuff I have within our house and our cars and all of that. It is more so the jealousy comes in from maybe an audience standpoint. Last month, we all took a vacation. We call it Brocation. We went to Breckenridge, where me and a number of guys that are online, Joshua Becker was one, Jeff Goins, a number of people who we brought together, and we went on this guy vacation. And at one point, we were sitting around at Starbucks, and I looked around, and there was Mark Chernoff. Him and his wife run a site called markandangel.com, Joshua Becker, and then Seth Spears, whose wife Katie runs a site called Wellness Mama. The traffic in the audience that collectively these three people have, I'm like, I'm sitting around with half the internet. And I kind of jokingly said that because, you know, between the three people, I get like 100 million page views a month. It's crazy. And I was like, and there is to some degree a little bit of envy there where I'm like, I wish I had such a platform. But I do. I mean, because our company, Copy, we have a huge, you know, email list, a subscriber base, customer list. So as the company, you know, we have that, what I'm looking for. But there's that part of me that wishes, like, with no cyber, I'm like, man, it'd be really cool to, you know, have, like, Joshua's got like 350,000 Facebook fans. I'm like, I would love to experience that type of audience. But it, you know, that type of stuff usually 98% of the time is just, it stops at inspiration. It helps, you know, motivate me and all of that. And very rarely do I ever actually let that get into dangerously bad water where, you know, I resent people, because that's just not me. I'd rather be friends with them than resent them. And so, you know, for me, thankfully, I've been able to shield myself from kind of the temptations of, you know, getting really, you know, mean feeling or bad spirited about stuff like that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I don't know, I think this is one of the topics that it's fun to hear people talk openly about, because if someone were to say to me that they've never experienced like any kind of jealousy or comparison with anyone else on the internet, I wouldn't believe that. It comes up for everyone, you know, in their own ways. And it's usually for me, like when I'm in that place where I'm finding myself like very jealous or comparison-y or, you know, whatever word we want to use, it's usually a reflection of what's going on with me. Like it's meaning that I'm not really doing my own work, right? Or like not like doing stuff that I really care about. Because when I have like so much excess time to just like hit refresh and like continue to scroll through other people's shit on the internet, probably I'm not really spending a lot of time doing my own things. Like the cure for the jealousy for me, if there ever is one, is like close the internet and like actual just like make progress and move the needle forward on your own things. Like that tends to be a pretty quick cure for me.
Yeah. And that circles back for me authentically to, I've always been a believer when jealousy or any envy, any of that comes to the surface, it's usually an indication of not necessarily what someone else has, but what you don't have. And it's to your point, which is, it's not a question of the fact that Joshua's got 300,000 people. It's the fact that I only have 25, and what am I doing about that to grow it? And I'm not. And so that's where that's where those resented feelings are more a reflection of what I'm not doing and what I'm doing wrong versus what someone else is doing right.
Yeah. For me, I also find that it's a reflection of like what I am making that other person's success or whatever, what I'm making that mean, right? Like it's easy to say, oh, well, you know, he has 300 million followers or whatever. And so therefore he is, you know, smarter than me, better than me, you know, or like what, you know, like you kind of pull it out into mean something that it doesn't necessarily mean, right? Like it's, as we know, what you said before about kind of like the luck and talent and timing and like that cocktail of stuff. Like we never know like what it is that makes someone popular. It's not necessarily because they're like a better human being or that they're happier, mm-hmm. or that, but I think it's really easy from an outside perspective to make assumptions about that type of stuff. And that's where sometimes it gets tricky for me too. Like when I'm assuming that, you know, because this person has X following or, you know, got a book deal or did whatever that, you know, they are all of such and such things better than me. Like that's where it starts to get like into like a very like downward spiral place.
Yeah.
So from following you online, it seems like your personal relationship with the internet, right, like outside of kind of the business and stuff that you do, particularly when it comes to blogging and social media, has shifted a lot in the past year or so. And I'm curious, first of all, if you think that's fair and if you can talk about what that has felt like a little bit.
Yeah, I shift a lot, again, because I'm a feeler and because I go through seasons of sprintingness. I have a tendency, and I do this on my personal domain, which is I have this ongoing joke that I give my audience whiplash because, you know, one day BrianGerner.com is all about design and tutorials and things like that. And then all of a sudden I'm like, well, no, I don't want to do that anymore. So I'm going to write authentically. So it's going to be a personal journal. And so I shift it back over to that. And a lot of times what happens really is it's just kind of my way of needing to express myself in certain ways. And because I have the ability to, from a programmatic standpoint and a design standpoint, point to shift that quickly because I'm capable of doing my own work, that's a blessing and a curse. And so, you know, it's tough because we're almost 5.5 years into the copy blogger story. And I've been design guy at Studio Press for 5.5 years on top of what it was before that. And so sometimes I get bored. And so now I want to focus on this. And so, you know, I think irresponsibly, I shift myself around more than I should. Primarily, the real reason behind why that happens is because there's no repercussions. That I don't derive income from that. So it's easy for me to change, you know, directions, whereas that's a bad example for someone who's basically trying to feed their family or pay their bills by what they do online. And so it's kind of like a do as I say, not as I do type of thing. And so I have to kind of try to, illustrate that, hey, don't necessarily redesign your website every 6 weeks because that's bad for branding. I do it because it's my sandbox for stuff I do for Studio Press. And so I think I've trained my audience to follow kind of the ebbs and flows of what I do online. And so for the most part, there's really, you know, it's pretty understood that that's just how Brian does stuff.
Yeah, no, I love this actually because I think it speaks a lot to the like being clear on the why or the intention or the purpose behind like any given project or website or whatever. Because even though you are the one who built, right, the things that you're doing and or like a major player in other things. At this point, I mean, it seems like they've grown, I don't want to say like grown beyond you, not in a negative way, but like they exist larger than just like you, Brian, personal brand, like what you had for breakfast, right? Like that it's, and in a way, I think that that can be great because it gives you, like part of what I struggled with and I wound up taking, you know, a couple months sabbatical and basically like shutting down the entire business side of my business was because I got to kind of a breaking point with a lot of these things that it didn't exist outside of me. Like that people think, oh, I want this, just this personal brand and I want to like make money off of like being me. But that can come with its own traps. Like I think there's something, at least to me, that sounds like pretty attractive to have like some separation between this is my personal blog and like I'm going to redesign this as much as I want because whatever, this is funsies versus like being clear on, okay, this is Studio Press, this is for business. And it gives you some leeway to have like those different, like you said, like to have a sandbox to just like play around.
Yeah, I think for me though, as much as I want to and have a need to do personal stuff, for me, and maybe it's a fear, like an unnecessary fear. For me, it always, whatever I do personally, in some capacity, can still benefit the company. From whether I'm building my personal brand through it, which ultimately exposes them to the stuff that we do, or even stuff like No Sidebar, where you know I spent time on the content and the site and the building the audience, but I took the design that I did for No Sidebar and packaged that, and we now sell it on Studio Press. And so there's always that degree of, okay, I can justify the stuff I do sometimes personally because there's still company benefit to it, right? Where, you know, I'll invest in doing some things on something like No Sidebar, but as long as there's that, you know, hey, I put a link to our software at the bottom of the website. And so I kind of, you know, always convince myself that it's okay I think we all need to have some sort of personal outlets, whatever they look like, because, you know, otherwise we become, you know, company robots, and that's really no good because at some point we'll get to that meltdown phase we talked about, you know, earlier in the show. But And so for me, I'm like, okay, it's safe to do personal stuff because A, I'm not making money on it. And B, because really what it's meant to do on top of the obvious, which is connect with people and build a personal brand, it's also helping build the umbrella of the company stuff. So I'm very particular with what I do personally so that it's not, you know, I would never start a Twilight blog.
Right. You know. But you should. I would agree. I'd be your first subscriber. No, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but that actually, that brings up another kind of question for me, you know, cause especially the language that you use around that, like I can justify doing this personal thing because it benefits the company. And I remember one of the things from one of your blog posts that I read that I wound up writing down that like really, really stuck with me. You said something like, you know, my biggest failure is that while I do a lot, I'm not great at just being me. And so I'm wondering, like, where is there like a part of your life that is just for fun, just for you, or that like an area where you feel like I can just be me, like with no potential repercussions for the company or for anyone else or anything like that?
I don't know if I do have, because everything I do now, and as much as I love the internet, I hate the internet, because everything I do always has some lens or layer of, can I monetize this? Can I build an audience? I mean, I honest to God had the domain twilightfans.com registered at one point because there's all that just, it's the entrepreneurial mindset, which is I have an idea. I want to do something. You know, I've had running blog domains before because I'm like, and it's so hard because the mixing of business and pleasure is sometimes a slippery slope. And so what I've tried to do is find the things that I personally am interested in that align with, you know, potentially business things. And then I feel safe in that because I can listen to music. That's one of my passions. I can run throughout the day. I can hang out at Starbucks. And those are three personal things that scratch, you know, that are itches that need to be scratched. But I can do all of those and still have company stuff be around that. So yeah, I don't have any really secret, like I don't do anything that's 100% separate from like internet world just because I'm just wired not to be that way.
Interesting. I feel sometimes that I am like struggling between like wanting two completely different lives. One is like connection and creativity online and like a lot of stuff that we've been talking about versus like wanting to like live in the woods or like live in a van and like travel around and like hike around. And I don't know, like that it's just sometimes I feel like, oh man, like I need to do more stuff that's like not online, which makes me wonder, not that this is going to happen, but like hypothetically, like the internet disappears or like any number of things happen where you can't do all of the things that you're doing. What's your like alternative life? Like what would that look like? Or do you even think about that?
Well, let me ask you a question. Let's just say you totally disconnected and you jumped in a van and drove across the country and saw the world. Is there any part of you that would not want to document that, create a blog around it, put it on Instagram, build an audience around people wanting to do the same thing? There's no part of me that would ever be able to do that without the fact that I would have to express that in some capacity.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, I think for me that when I think about doing that way, that is more of touches on the reasons that I love the internet, right? This idea to just like connect and share and connect and share as opposed to trying to monetize from it. Not that there's anything wrong with monetization, but I agree with you that I think the slope can get slippery between like that. I went through a period of time where I like lost the ability to just do stuff for fun. Like everything that I did, well, how can I turn this around and make this a business? Or how could this, you know, be a website or be whatever? That part of when I think about this like other life, it's not necessarily that I wouldn't ever share it, but it's like separating, I don't know, I don't even really know what I'm saying, but separating out the need to like every single thing has to be like part of a brand or part of a business.
Well, I'll explain to you very specifically how that looks. So 2 years ago, we started this thing called Brocation, which was supposed to be designed for a couple of internet friends, guys, to go up to the mountains, disconnect, do all of the things that we just talked about, right? So the first year, four of us went up there, and it was great. Last year, or this past year, so what, 2 months ago, 10 of us went. I had to create a website around it. It's at gobrocation.com because it gets commercialized. It's just the nature of like the entrepreneurial mind. Not that I even make money off of it, but the idea of building a brand. Okay, now people resonate with the word brocation. They associate it with me. They see the pictures of Colorado when we went. And so this year, I'm like, let me create a website to sort of start some sort of branding around it. And then maybe it becomes a conference. And again, like as always, something that starts out very simple and, you know, good-natured and meant to be to disconnect from all of the stuff that it became. And it's just how it works.
Did that process change how you felt about the trip?
No, because for me, it was really more like I was less the second year. I was less like I need to disconnect and remove myself from the internet, which I don't think we can ever do because we always have phones. We always have Wi-Fi and all of that. It was more just a matter of, you know, I'm getting older. And really what it came down to is I wanted to do this so that I could deepen friendships I had with guys online and as an excuse to go skiing and be in the mountains and experience geography that's not close to where I live. And that's been okay. Like, I've kind of shifted that, hey, this is cool. This is what it became. We had 10 of us. It was great. I'm like, wow, this is getting to a point where if we had many more, then it would lose kind of the original kind of closeness thing. But maybe that's okay, because then I start justifying, well, maybe this is like a retreat conference, a creative thing, and we have 100 people. And, you know, then your mind goes into that type of, you know, WDS type thing. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this was supposed to be like a vacation for four friends, you know?
Yeah, no, but you know, it's funny. I feel like this conversation around the internet and social media and like what we portray versus what we don't, like that obviously comes up in, it comes up in pretty much like every single episode that I've done in some capacity. And of all the people that I've talked to, both on the podcast and just like in my personal life, like what you're saying feels to me to be like very organic and very authentic. That like when you say like, well, that's just how I'm wired, like I feel that from you. And I don't think that's the case with a lot of people. Like I think it's more for me, like I think it's more of a struggle to, you know, to keep things separate, because I look at sometimes what I'm doing online and I'm like not necessarily doing it for the right reasons, right? Like this is for social validation, or this is for this. Is this like an, I think I'm always in like an evolution of why and how I'm using the internet. But I think everything that you're saying like totally makes sense to me, right? Like how things kind of like grow, and that's just the nature of things. And partially this, I want to live in a van and like do whatever. Part of that is just kind of like grass is greener, you know, fantasy escapism type of stuff.
Yeah, no, I would, as a guy who spends time like looking into the idea of tiny houses because of no sidebar and all of that, for me, I would be in a tiny house probably 2 months before I needed to get out of it. So yeah. I hear you.
I mean, I would totally want to live in a tiny house. My husband would never, ever go for that. So I think I want my marriage more than I want the tiny house. But actually, that brings up a question. So with kind of this interest in kind of minimalism and more deliberate living, are those values that you and Shelley share together?
For the most part, yes. Not at all saying she's materialistic. I think that we do differ in some things. I think I would be more comfortable in a smaller house than what we have. And I think that she would too. It's not a question of, you know, we have to have a certain size house or anything like that. But because she's type A and I'm type B, she's administrative and I'm creative, we look a lot at things differently and all of that. And so I'm a feeler, she's a thinker. And so we really complement each other well, because I think if it were me, I'd go buy a tiny house and we'd move there. But she holds us back. She grounds me from some of the things that I, you know, these fantasies that I create in my head. And so, you know, the big picture is that the things in life, we both like to run, family's important. We like where we live, the church that we go to, the friends that we have. You know, those are the things that really matter that we have to be aligned on. And so, you know, for the big picture, yeah. And so the brocation thing was a good example, because she's not a mountain person. She doesn't like cold weather. And I didn't want to not go and experience those, because that kind of breeds resentment within a marriage. And so finally I walked downstairs one day and I said, you know what? I'm going to go to Colorado. Is that cool? And she understands, like, hey, that you got to go scratch your itch. I don't necessarily want to go, so I won't. But, you know, so those communication in a relationship is also important, because if you don't get to do the things you like to do, not a good place to be sometimes.
No, totally. I love it. So the way that I want to wrap this up, the way that we wrap up all the episodes are with this season, there are 8 of them. They're called community questions. They're questions that Real Talk Radio listeners have asked to hear more about from each guest. So kind of 8 rapid fiery questions, but don't feel like you have to be super rapid in your answers, if that sounds good. Okay.
Yep.
So the first, and I say this every time, I hate the phrase guilty pleasure, because I think pleasure is a necessity and we shouldn't feel guilty about it. But for lack of a better phrase, what would you say is your current guilty pleasure?
I hate to keep coming back to this, but it's got to be Lana Del Rey.
I love it. I got to listen to some. I mean, I know who she is, and I definitely like her music. But now after this, I'm like sparked to go and like go on a listening binge.
The best way I can explain this, and I tweeted this, I don't know, a few days ago. To me, she's like Amy Winehouse was, which is the more I try to dislike her music, the more I'm drawn in. And when someone can do that to me, that is like insane, because I'm like, what is the hoopla around this girl? Or, you know, what's the big deal? And you listen to some of her music, and the first times you listen to it, you realize it's different than what's on the radio now. It's kind of a throwback to the 50s and 60s Hollywood era, and it doesn't sound like music that should be around now, but that's like what draws you in. It's kind of it's hypnotic in a weird way. And the fact that I admit that a singer has hypnotic powers over me is the only way I can say it's a guilty pleasure.
I love it. I think it's so great. Okay, the next question. Who are your 2 to 3 favorite people to follow on social media?
That is a great question, and I don't even know if I can give an answer, because on any given day, it could be different people. If I had to, I honestly don't know, because the people I follow on Instagram and things like that are the people who visually post things that that do something for me. And I don't want to sound all like weird, but honest to God, you're one of the people I like to follow, because you run and you post pictures of snow and mountains in Oregon, and it kind of helps me vicariously live what I can't through you. So you're a great person. I love to follow the stuff that you post, because I see that I'm like, good, someone's living, it's happy, stuff like that. But
that's a very nice thing to say, though. Thank you. Have you ever been to Bend, Oregon? Have you been to Bend?
You know, I have not. Tish Oxenreiter, I think, lives up in Bend. And I've been meaning to get up to WDS, because I know all kinds of people. One of our employees lives in Portland, Robert Bruce. The Pacific Northwest, not including the whole ties to Twilight, or even Astoria back in the day. I think that's where Goonies was supposedly filmed. But the Pacific Northwest is one area of the country I've never been, and I wish I could go to. I've got friends that live in Seattle, and at some point I will make my way up there.
You should definitely come. You are totally welcome in Bend anytime, and we can go do fun mountain things. And the weather's a little whatever right now. But I will say, about the Twilight thing. A couple years ago, I dragged a few of my girlfriends to Forks, Washington, where Twilight is based, as you know, and went on like the full on like multi-hour Twilight tour. I cried twice during the tour, like cried when we got into Forks. Like, it was incredible. I had this like complete fangirl. Anyway, so it's beautiful up there. But yes, come to the Pacific Northwest. Okay, so the next question, if you could go back and change one thing from your past, what would it be, or would you even change anything?
Another great question, but I'm gonna opt out and say nothing, because there's nothing in my life now that I wish was totally different. I have the security of a big company. I get to do what I do within that company on a daily basis. You know, I work in my underwear. I go to Starbucks sometimes, not in my underwear, by the way. I listen to music all day long. I'm around for my kid. I have a good marriage. I get to run what I want. I mean, there's no part of my life right now on a normal level that I would say, you know, this sucks, or I wish it was totally different. So I wouldn't change anything.
Which is perfect, because it reads right into the next question, leads into the next question of, what would you say is the biggest challenge that you're facing right now in any area of your life? And what's one thing that you're doing to work on it?
Staying focused. You know, I it's easy to say I'm a creative, so I don't have to stay focused. And there's some truth in that, but I also need to continue to produce and to grow our brand and do stuff like that. And so I think the biggest challenge, if there's anything, is to maintain my focus on company stuff and not so much on the personal stuff, regardless of how much I can justify it back and forth. So this year for me is a good stay focused on the company, build Studio Press, do lots of design stuff, and take some of the stuff I've learned through No Sidebar in that whole experience and apply it to the company.
Yeah. Okay. So I know that we've talked about that you're not really a reader, so this next question might not be as relevant for you, because usually I ask people which 2 or 3 books have had the biggest impact. But actually, I guess if you're not a big reader, I'm even more curious if there is a book that stands out that amongst not loving reading, is there something that you were like, yeah, but that was great?
Talking about the book Packing Light by my friend Allison Vesterfeld, she wrote something inside of that book, one sentence, 11 words, or is it 10? Can't remember. Usually when I read a book, it's for one, just so I can pull out one thing from it. And it's funny, I'll read books, I'll get halfway through, and when I get to that point, I don't feel like I have to read the book anymore, because I got out of it what I was supposed to. And what she wrote was, how does it go? Where your passion meets their need, that is your calling. And that is something I've hooked myself onto. It's probably the single most important thing I've ever read in any book or magazine ever. And so when you identify like what you want to do and you find an audience or a group of people who would need that from you, that is what you're meant to do.
I love that. I actually read her book on you made the recommendation sometime online, and I really enjoyed it. So I'll definitely put links to that in the show notes as well.
Good.
Okay, a couple more questions. When you're feeling stuck in a rut, what's something that you know you can do to get yourself out of it?
Good question, because do I actually do that? No. When I get into a rut, the first thing I should do is close the internet and go walk away and spend an hour running or go to run an errand or do something completely mindless. But like most dumb people, I will continue to bang my head up against the wall in the hopes that I can pound through it. And so from a productivity standpoint, it's reverse psychology, because the more time away, the more I would actually get done. But so I spend a lot of my time spinning my wheels creatively or otherwise. And so what I need to get better at is just learning, walk away, like close the computer, shut down Photoshop, reset your mind, go do something else, come back, recalibrate, and do something good. So
yeah, I think that has a lot to do with trust, right? Like trusting that like if I walk away, like the answer will come or the thing will be there, right? Like I tend to, it's from a very control freak perspective for me that I think if I just keep sitting here and keep forcing it that the thing is going to come, when actually if I just like trust that I can like step away from it. Yeah, I struggle with that too. What would you say is one lesson that keeps coming up for you, something that it seems like you need to personally learn and relearn over and over again in your life?
I will go back and use the running analogy, because I use this a lot from a business perspective, and that is the idea of, you know, breaking through the wall, like sticking with something long enough to get through to the end. Because a lot of times, not so much now, but like early on, I would do something, and the second that it was uncomfortable or something didn't come out right, or the first hate message I got, like I would shut down and like do something different. And so, you know, trying to be, and this actually does a lot for building trust within an audience when you. And it's something I'm proud of with No Sidebar. It was a silly idea. I executed, I built a site, and it's coming up on the year anniversary. And I'm actually kind of proud in a weird way that I've stuck with that for so long. And so for me, it really is just the matter of, you know, sticking. I mean, don't hang on to things that just have no value or no potential, but being able to like stay true to yourself and to stay with integrity and follow through things that you say you're going to do. And like we talked earlier, be very careful about what you say you're going to do, because as we know, we get held up against that. But so that's probably what I would say.
Yeah, I love it. So when you look ahead at the next few months, what do you feel most excited about?
Work.
Any particular aspect or just all of it?
Just work. Yeah, no, just the idea of coming kind of to a point where I'm ready to and have the map and the resources to do a lot of stuff with Studio Press that over the last couple of years, you know, the company's been focused on some of the other software elements and, you know, through great conversations and lots of growth strategies, you know, I get to do again what basically I started. And I'm excited about that because we have a huge community, 180,000 customers that I get to, you know, try to please and to serve and to communicate with. So without a doubt, I would say kind of the reinvention of Studio Press.
That's awesome. So for people who are interested and kind of want to find you and say hi online, what's your favorite way to connect with people?
I would probably say Twitter. As much as I know Twitter's dying and all of that stuff, it's the easiest way to go back and forth. I'm good at email because I don't like a cluttered inbox. And so I'm always responding to stuff right away. But Twitter is the best way, because I think you get to have conversations in front of people, which sometimes can be valuable for a number of reasons. And so Twitter at B Gardner is where I'm at.
Yeah, I love it. And I'll put links to everything else too in the show notes. And you mentioned a lot of great kind of people and resources and things. So the show notes will be nice and robust. But this was awesome, Brian. Thank you so much.
You know, it as much as I enjoyed the idea of being on the show, I cannot wait to hear the produced version of it, because I think we covered like everything from left to right in my life. And so I'm asked all the time, hey, what's the story of Studio Press or any of it? I'll be able to say, I think we covered most of that on this show, and I'm going to be linking to this all the time. You want to hear like the story of my life in every capacity? Go here.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening and for being a part of the Real Talk Radio community. If you love what we're doing here, and if you want to support the show and get exclusive access to bonus audio content that's released in the in-between months between podcast seasons, visit patreon.com/NicoleAntoinette for simple instructions on how to become a VIP supporter who gets fun rewards. Until next time, here's a big virtual hug and a reminder that we're all just doing the best we can, and that no matter what, we're in this together.